Hi everyone, I'm Darren Nair, the creator and host of Pod Hostage Diplomacy. We're currently taking an extended break right now because I'm dealing with health issues. We will be back once I have fully recovered. Thank you so much for listening to Pod Hostage Diplomacy, and take care. Welcome to Pod Hostage Diplomacy. We work to free hostages and the unjustly detained around the world. Together with their families, we share their stories every week and let you know how you can help bring them home. I'm Darren Nair, and I've had the honor of campaigning with many of these families for years. These are some of the most courageous and resilient people among us, people who have never given up hope, people who will never stop working to reunite their families. And we will be right there by their side until their loved ones are back home. Thank you for joining us. And now, let's meet this week's guest. Welcome to Pod Hostage Diplomacy. Nick Dunn is a British citizen and a former member of the Parachute Regiment within the British Army. He served in Afghanistan and Iraq. After leaving Her Majesty's forces, Nick continued to work in security. In October 2013, Nick worked as an armed security guard on board his company vessel, the MV Seaman Guard Ohio. His mission was to protect the vessel from Somali pirates. Nick was not the only British citizen on the ship working as an armed security guard. There were another five Brits who were also former British Armed Forces with him. A week later, the MV Seaman Guard Ohio was brought into port in Tamil Nadu by the Indian Coast Guard. 10 crew members and 25 guards, including Nick and the other five Brits, were arrested and placed in prison in Chennai, which is the capital city of Tamil Nadu. From then onwards, Nick and these five Brits would be known as the Chennai Six. They were accused of being illegally armed in Indian waters. This was not true. They had all the required documentation, and they had a legitimate reason to be in Indian waters, which is they needed to pick up emergency supplies as a result of stormy weather. They were granted bail 5 months later in March 2014, thanks to a petition signed by 136,000 people that was submitted to the British government. In January 2016, however, they were found guilty and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Almost 2 years later, in November 2017, a Chennai appeals court dismissed the case, and they were free to return home to the UK. So Nick Dunn and the rest of the Chennai Six, who are innocent, were only able to come home to their families 4 years after their arrest and wrongful imprisonment in India. Now, Nick has written a book about his experience called Surviving Hell. Today, we have the honor of speaking to Nick Dunn himself. Nick, first of all, thank you for your service in Her Majesty's forces. We're sorry for what you had to go through in India, and thank you for joining us.
No problem. Good evening. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Could you walk us through what happened?
I was doing armed security on the ship's anti-piracy role. Back in October 2013, I was on a client vessel going to Sri Lanka, and we were told by our company to get off that vessel and board our company vessel, the MV Seaman Guard Ohio. We ceased operations, and we obviously needed fuel and provisions. So everyone who deals in that gets that sorted. And we had to seek shelter, which under maritime law you can, to a friendly neighbouring country. And India was that neighbouring country. But things took a turn for the worst. We started taking fuel on the evening of the 12th of October. And the next morning, we were kind of rudely awakened by our tactical deployment officer, who is the guy that's in charge of the guards, who issues the kit and equipment before going and coming from a merchant vessel. He told us we had been boarded by the Indian Coast Guard at gunpoint, and we were told that we had to make our way to the port of Tuticorin. We were kind of left in the dark. We weren't known why we had been apprehended. They wouldn't say nothing, just get to port. And I came on deckside and I was like, why are we going so slow? And they were like, I have no idea. But the reason why we're going so slow is because they had to make a spectacle out of things. They had to have personnel in place, i.e. media, whatnot. To which we found out once entering the port, it was a welcome committee. And you're thinking, if, you know, later down the line they said they found us up to no good. And I was thinking, well, if you found that we were up to no good, how have you gotten so many people portside from different organisations around India? Some of these organisations came as far as Mumbai. Unless they've got a very fast private jet, how did they get there in that time? I believe, and I'm, you know, pretty damn sure others feel the same way, it was a seizure exercise. We were sold down the river. We were made an example of. Because if you see something suspicious on your radar, you send the Coast Guard out to go and see what the problem is. They've been told something, to which has alerted a lot of different organisations in India, to which they got there in good time. So they knew where we were, and they were waiting for the certain people to turn up in Tuticorin before coming to apprehend us, because we were at anchor. We were taking fuel and provisions. We weren't doing nothing wrong. Yes, we were in Indian waters, but under the maritime law, you can be in their waters, especially when you're seeking shelter from a cyclone. And we weren't entering the port, so we don't have to tell them we're coming to port. But we were in their waters. We've never denied the fact that we weren't. But when they turn around and say, we have illegal weapons, there was 35 personnel on that vessel, and those 35 weapons, they basically put two and two together and come up with 10. The only weapons that they said were illegal were the 5 G3s, which, funny enough, were ticked off, signed off, paperwork provided by the UK government. Yet Indian government turned around and said they don't hold any value or, you know, clearance outside of UK waters. And we're like, no, that doesn't work like that. They're used for maritime operations, solely of maritime operations. So basically, we were, pardon my French, in the shit before we even knew it, because it didn't matter what we did, they wouldn't batter an eyelid. They didn't care. They knew what they were doing, and it was to make an example of. At the time, we weren't aware of this. We were just told to keep out the way, and just, if you get called, you know, come and speak to the police officers. When we were in port, it was manic. We had to formulate a bit of security on the bridge, on the gangway, because everyone was just piling on, and we're like, who are these people? Where's your ID? That kind of upset them. And I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. If you start letting so many people on this vessel, you're going to capsize with. And who are these people? We're not letting random people. We need to know who yous are. So it kind of upset them, like rubbed them up the wrong way. And I'm thinking, well, you're in a white shirt, no identification, but you're saying you're police. Show me, prove it. You know, and we had different organisations, like I say, far as Mumbai, and every organisation were handing Seaman's book, were passports at the time, and just certain people would get asked the odd question, stupid questions, non-related to the incident questions. Like one of the Estonians was asked, so you've been to Afghanistan, have you lost anyone? And he was like, who the hell do you think you are asking me this question? You know? So, you know, the captain didn't play a game. He locked himself in his cabin. That infuriated the police. Would we still have had the outcome if he complied? Yes, 100%. But with him infuriating the police, it did kind of make matters a bit worse because, unfortunately, they don't like the piss taken out of them, and he was quite frankly doing that. He should have just complied, because if you start screaming and shouting and not complying, the police are going to suspect you are hiding something. If you comply, but it's down to them to prove your wrongdoing. So from the off, it was a nightmare. We showed, you know, I didn't personally, but we showed them the weapons, the paperwork, the ammunition, to all these different organisations, and they were going, well, there's nothing to be had here. And they left. And I think the local Boys Q branch were getting a bit pissed off. They were thinking, hang on a minute, something's not right here. We're going to look like a bunch of idiots here. So it got to their turn, and they turned around and went, we found weapons. And then they got their media and made a massive mountain out of a molehill. And a couple of days later, they removed the weapons. And then on the morning of the 18th of October, 2013, pretty early, so back in the UK at the time, we were 4.5 hours behind. People were asleep, my family were asleep. I've already spoken to my family, telling them what's going on. I've had my family, especially my dad, question my job, question what I'm actually doing, because they'd started writing stuff online, and my family have read this. The Estonian families have read this, saying we are up to no good. Selling weapons to fishermen, we're doing a Mumbai-style attack on the nuclear power plant in Tamil Nadu. All these stories were coming out online, and it's not very nice when you're 5,000 miles away, not knowing your next move, and you've got your dad on the phone saying, right, I'm reading this. I want to know the truth. Are you up to no good, or are you doing protection work? I said, I'm doing protection work. He went, right, I believe you. And then, you know, like, time went on, and it got to that morning, and they said, right, you're going to hospital for checkup. And we're like, why are we going to hospital for? There's nothing wrong with it. But we complied. They're stupid, but they're cunning, and they're doing it, and they're devious, and they know what, you know, they make a game out of things. You know, to the outside, they look daft, but really, they know what they're doing. They're not stupid. And they had us by the balls. But they didn't, because they just made everything up. They just wanted to ruin our lives, make an example of, because two Italian Marines killed two Indian fishermen and they couldn't punish them. That is it. Simple, bottom line. Should it have happened? Damn right it shouldn't. It didn't have to happen. But it did. And this was the start of a 4-year nightmare. I don't really class them days from the 12th to the 18th. I don't, because that can happen anywhere. You know, basically we thought, well, here we go. They'll probably want a bit of a bribe to let we go. You know, I've heard many stories where your passport's a little bit frayed and they'll go, ooh, something's not right with that. Because they know the money you make and they just want a bit of, you know, involvement in it. Normally that on in them countries around the world, money talks. You know, if you want your freedom, make sure you've got a wad of cash on you, because, you know, freedom comes at a price. But the worst thing was making that phone call, because we're not stupid. We know we're getting arrested. However, they went, you're going to the hospital, but you can't take your wallet, you can't take your watch, you can't take your phone. People who had reading glasses couldn't take their reading glasses, and yet there was put with paper in front of them saying, sign this. He's like, well, I can't bloody read. You've took my glasses off us. Can't take a belt, can't take cigarettes for those who smoke. And you're thinking, what kind of hospital are we going to? You know, so we're not stupid. So we're all professional. We'll put our company uniform on because we're representing the company. We're wanting to show the media, the world, because this is going to happen, that we are not guilty people. We've done no wrongdoing. We're showing that we're representing our company, showing that we're professional. And it was just it was manic. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I wouldn't say one of the hardest. It's probably one of the things that I wish I never had to do, because that's the only memory I've got in regards to my mum. But I tried ringing my sister, and with the time difference, she'd never answered in time. So I rang my mum, and my mum's tablets didn't kick in, so she was kind of still awake, but groggy. And I said to my mum, right, it's gone tits up. We're getting arrested. I don't know when I'll see you or speak to you again, but I love you, and I'll see you soon. That's the last time I've ever heard my mum speak properly. 5 days before Christmas 2013, she suffered a double aneurysm when I was in prison, and it's massively affected her speech. So, like, I've got no videos of her speaking, and the only memory I've got is that phone call, and it eats away at me every day. Yes, one day it will ease a bit, but it's still raw now. It still hurts. And then my sister kind of rung us back, and I went, right, get the embassy. Shit's going down now. I love you. Speak to you soon. And that was it. The nightmare begins. However long it was going to take, we don't know. We got carted off on the buses, media everywhere, hanging out the vans, trying to get pictures, sirens going, you name it. This was big for the Indians, especially in Tuticorin, in South India and Tamil Nadu. This was big news. This is boom. And we went to the police station. We had no agent from the company. We had no embassy staff. We had no interpreter. Well, we did. One of the crew, he was from Tamil Nadu. So in a way, he's acting as a suspected terrorist, gun runner, criminal, but acting as our interpreter at the same time. And he's getting grilled off the police. So he was in a very difficult position, and I felt sorry for him. And they were just shouting at me, sign this or we'll ruin your lives. And I'm thinking, it's a blank piece of paper. I'm not signing a note. You know, put me in a tiny little room, probably a bottle of water, no food, nothing. And this was from like 8 o'clock in the morning, as far as I recall. And it went on right all the way through, all day. No food, just water, They did bring a pack of cigarettes to give to the ones who smoked, you know. It was just, it was hot, stifling. You're anxious. You're scared in a way. You got foreign personnel screaming and shouting in their mother tongue, and you haven't got a clue what they're saying. So you're just trying to remain calm as best as you can. I wasn't thinking of my family at the time. I was thinking of there and now, because that's what I had to do. My family will have to deal with what's going on when they decide to, you know, deal with it. But I had bigger things on my plate. I had to know what on earth was going down. And nothing, no one to represent were, it was disgusting. You know, there was, we found out apparently that the company representative turned up, but he got a bit of a hot collar and he disappeared. Apparently we're told the embassy got refused entry to Seewa. Mind, if that was true, that's a diplomatic incident that no one should be rejected to see your consular staff. Definitely not. Especially when they can act as interpreters as well, which that's what the British government does with their embassy staff. They hire the local people to act as relations, which is a good idea, isn't it? We got carted from the police station to a court. It was nighttime. Some guy turned out because the court was closed. We had to go around the back. A guy in a suit came out, waffled something. We got back on the bus, and then that was us. Off to Palam Koti Prison, the first prison we went to, a prison that was built during the British rule. So you can imagine how daunting it looks from the outside. Some prison that was built in the 1800s. The prison staff weren't, you could, once I found out there was six British, they were more or less doing cartwheels. They were like shoes on the other foot now. Yeah? And I was just thinking, is this a nightmare? What on earth is going on here? You know, still with the ink and the thumbprint with a big book, massive big book like that, right? You're getting nicked, you're in prison. Here's your dog bowl. Here's your spoon. Here's your two sheets. Crack on. Ta-da. And we all got chucked in this this little outhouse room thing with a hole in the floor as a toilet. And like a big thing where you could fill your buckets up with water and have a bucket wash. So you'd stand in the open square and just chuck buckets of water. And that was your way to try and have a wash. Well, I had to wash because we'd been sweaty in the police station all day. We were dehydrated, hanging out. They gave her a little bit of food. They gave her onion omelets, chapatis, not very well cooked jacket potatoes. They were still hard and raw inside, but it was after 11 o'clock at night when we got to the prison. So all day of not knowing what's going on, we're now thrown in this prison. And then, once that door shut, you were just thinking, is this it? Is this where I'm going to stay for however long? Like, sorry for swearing, but what the fuck? Like, how do you digest that? You're an innocent man. You know you've done nothing wrong and you're halfway across the world and you're put in a prison. How do you comprehend that? What goes through your head? Well, what went through my head is, right, let's try and keep my head on my shoulders and not think of home too much. Let's go back to my military training. And that helped immensely. You know, what you learn when you go through your training and battalion life and going on operations, it does mentally toughen you up. It's more physical, but it does mentally tough you up. And I needed that. I really did for the years to come. This was the beginning. This wasn't hard. The tough times they're on their way, but you weren't aware at the time. You didn't know. We were there for a couple of days, and then we got told the 23 foreigners are going to Chennai. And we were like, why? Why isn't all 35 of them going up? Don't know. They kept the Indians down in that prison, in that compound. And we went up to Chennai, Puzzle Central Prison 2, the remand prison. We got there at night time. It was daunting again, these big gates, and you're thinking, oh my God, what is going on? And in that prison from the main entrance, it was nearly a mile walk to our compound where they put foreign nationals. So we were all chucked in cells. I shared a little, I think it was like 10 by 8, small cell with a hole in the floor as a toilet. I shared that with three other guys, two Brits, one Estonian. And I shared that from October to April when we got released for bail. It was tough. Conditions were excruciating at times. The heat, the mosquitoes. There was the odd dodgy spider. There was snakes that the Indians killed, chucked on a fire, then ate. You know, these spiders, these snakes, if they bit you, you're dead. They're dead. You're dead. You ain't got no chance of getting out of that prison alive. Or unless you've got a very good immune system and you fight back. But, you know, like one of the Estonians, he had something wrong with his gut, very pain, and he was screaming and shouting, well, like, what's going on? And one of the prison guards came, he was like, what's the matter? And we're like, he needs doctor, morning. And you're like, no, this man could die. He had stomach ulcers. He finally got checked out, and they said, oh, by the way, you got stomach ulcers, mate. I was like, oh, Chaz, good job they didn't pop, because that could be very life-threatening. But, yeah, the first prison, you know, Palm Court, we were only there a couple of days, thank the Lord, because we probably would have been carted out of that in very poor health. We managed to walk out the second prison in poor health. I like going to the gym, and I was pretty a decent size. But when I came out of that prison after, we barely ate. We were lucky to eat a meal. And sometimes the vegetables were rotten. They'd been attacked by rats, probably pissed on by cats, because they were just laid on the floor. And, you know, there was cats everywhere in this prison. And you know, you had mouths to feed. And they were giving us this kind of rations. And you're like, I'm lucky if I can feed three people with this. I've got 23 mouths to feed, because at the first, we're all cooked. Like, we made our little cooking teams, and every day we'd go to the kitchen and get the hot water and make food. So we did that. So we're not like Gordon Ramsay. I'm sure we probably gave each other food poisoning once or twice, but you learn, you know. Everyone's got different eating habits, like what they like to eat. The food that we got, the stew was the main easy option. Everyone likes a good stew, especially in winter, more so broth. But that's what it kind of was. But at that time, it was very bland because we didn't have the condiments. So it was tough. It's like, ugh, but you've got to eat it. Don't be twisting your nose, because you need to stay healthy, and where our health is deteriorating. I remember one time we all went down with this bug, and it spread like wildfire. I remember lying on this like thin mattress that the embassy brought in, just to act as a bit of comfort instead of lying on the slate floor. But with the heat, it kind of shrinks for some reason. And I was just lying there and I was in absolutely turmoil. My guts were in shit state. I felt ill. I felt weak. I was like, I'm going to die here. We had in the compound outside toilets that we used during the day till 6 o'clock when we got locked up. Then we'd use our cell toilet, which was quite pleasant. Needs must, I suppose. You know, we're all big boys. You know, we all have loose motion with the heat and the food that we eat, so you can imagine, you know, it doesn't take a rocket science to work out. And I needed the toilet, so I'm lying on this mattress and I kind of get up and I'm like, I only get like halfway, so I come out my cell, down the corridor, out the main, into the courtyard kind of thing where the toilets were, and I got halfway and I just went bleh. I just puked up. I then shat myself, to be polite. And I'm stood there and I'm laughing, but I'm crying at the same time. And I'm like, I want me mum. I want me mum. I'm going to die here. You know what I mean? I can laugh about that now, but at the time it was serious. It was like, we're going to die here. You know, like, it was awful. But we'll in that prison, we met some characters. You know, there was Nigerians. There was Syrians, there was the odd Russian, there was some Chinese guy with a redwood and all that, dodgy money and stuff like that. It's Tamil Tigers. There was a few different people. We didn't really get to mix with the local nationals at then. They were kind of just hurling us abuse. So when we had to go to get our vegetables and go to the kitchen, that was like another mile. And you pass, and you walk up the main drag, and you're passing all the compounds, and all the Indians are out and about, and they're just hurling abuse. You know, you don't need to a translator to work out that it's verbal abuse just by the tone. And obviously, you get to learn certain words, which we spoke to a few English speaking Tamils. And there, they kind of translated for when they were like, you're getting nasty words said about you. One of the guys had a brick chucked at the back of his head. You know, luckily he wasn't too bad injured. But this has happened. Like, it didn't happen on an everyday occurrence, but just I think once they realised, you know, not to do it, because we had to put a complaint in by the embassy. But, you know, this is, you know, very dangerous. We're in a dangerous prison here. You all hear about the sharpening of a toothbrush and putting a razor blade in. And, you know, you hear, you know, especially on one incident when we were going to the kitchen, one of the Indians had his throat slit and there was blood going all over. He was screaming. Where was the guards? Nowhere to be seen. He's just a number to them. They're not interested. There was a big riot. Drugs. A big riot. Everyone was in lockdown, so we couldn't even go anywhere apart from going to the kitchen for food. And we had to be kind of escorted, as far as I remember. But it was tough in that, like, 5.5, 6 months. It was tough. It was an experience. It was horrible, especially when the embassy came in and gave me a letter and told us about my mum having a double aneurysm 5 days before Christmas. That was a very hard, hard point in my life, because I had to walk a mile back to that jailer's office, and I was walking back and just holding this letter, blurry-eyed, battling the red mist, walking tunnel vision. I could hear people screaming abuse at us. I could feel the odd stone hit me body, but the pain that I was going through was 10 times more. than what they could ever inflict on me. And I got back to the compound and I saw one of the other brick guys and I just broke down. I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. My mum's, this is what's happened. And he took me away, comforters, and, you know, get it off my chest because, you know, as I say, real men cry, real men got emotions, and my emotions have come out in the worst case scenario. And like, I'm my mum's baby. And she may die. Do you think they will allow me to go at the funeral? Definitely not. If they didn't, I would have kicked off big time. I would have kicked off. And but gladly, I'm very fortunate that never happened. So yeah, that was like the first start of the nightmare, being in that prison. Yeah, we got released on bail, and I don't know if that was a worse period. It wasn't bad. You know, I was able to socialize, go to the gym, nights out, rest. I wasn't living it up because it's costing my family money because I'm not getting paid. The company stopped paying me, even though they said they would, to the families they would pay with. They didn't pay with. Things aren't cheap. If I wanted to live like an Indian, yeah, but I can't eat rice and dal 24/7. I can't. I had enough of that for 5 months nearly. I'm certainly not going to eat it on when I can get a McDonald's or a Pizza Hut, you know, or just an actual meal from a restaurant. I did like a biryani on a Sunday, like, so I don't mind a biryani. I just say just chicken and rice, but, you know, a great fundamental meal for a gym guy. Being out, you know, you still had the case happening, going through the courts, getting moved, getting delayed, court closures, and you're like, oh my God, what's going on? Speaking with the embassy. Yes, I was able to Skype my family, which was fantastic. It was annoying, especially with the time difference, 4.5 to 5 hours, you know, the different times of the year. But I'm out of prison and I'm living in India in a hostel, and it's costing my family. So it was a massive financial burden. And you're thinking, well, what's going on? What's the British government doing? Why can't I get home? Why? I'm out on bail. And then a couple of months later, the case gets quashed. I do not have any charges against me. I am literally, technically, a free man. But it wasn't to be. Absolute madness. I was denied my freedom. Do I believe the British government could have done more at that time? Damn right. Of course it could. Especially when it states in Indian law that during the 90-day rule, I do not need to remain in India. However, do you think Tamil Nadu would sign off to allow me to go back to the UK? No. They wouldn't even listen to what New Delhi tells them to do. That's the problem with India. It's too state-run. Every state has a chief minister. They're to look after the state for the prime minister, i.e. Narendra Modi. But they don't. Unless the BJP, his party, then they're all right. But other parties, like in Tamil Nadu, they ain't going to listen. Absolutely not going to listen at all. New Delhi could have turned around and said, let them free. They've done nothing. We've seen the paperwork of the British government. They'll just go, no. Mad. Absolute mad. And you know, I've done a few podcasts. I've explained. I've said, you know, and I've had people say, Nick, are you exaggerating anything? I'll go, no. I don't need to exaggerate anything. I tell it how it is. And I tell it in a passionate way from the bottom of my heart. I've got no qualms, no way of needing to lie, to exaggerate things. It's a nightmare. And this was this was an ongoing nightmare, and we're, you know, getting frustrated. Squabbles amongst us. Squabbles amongst us with the government. We're all hurting. We're all missing our families. We're all financially hit. We're all innocent. But to those, we're guilty. We're bad men. So how does that affect you? It does. And it affects you hard. But you've got to deal with it. You have to keep heading towards that light at the end of the tunnel, regardless of how bright or dim it is. That's how I dealt with it. But I couldn't have done it on my own. I needed help. I needed me training from me army days. I needed the support that, you know, my sister accumulated from all the raising of awareness that her and the other family members did. Now, we had, my sister got in touch with Amnesty International, and this turned around and said, where's your sister, where's your brother at? She went, India. She went, can't do nothing there. And we're like, you're an international human rights organization, yet you won't go anywhere near India. Why is that? Absolute mental. It's like no one wants to touch India. It's like they're scared. And I'm thinking, why? We've done nothing. Come and help with. I fought for you. I worked, signed on the dotted line, gave my young adult life for Queen and country. At least help your personnel out, especially if they're innocent. And they didn't. With a deed. I've got no qualm about, I've got no bad word to say about the embassy staff. What they did for me and my family, like, you know, helping with the meal, helping with prison meats. I've got no problems. Other people may have problems. That's down to them. I personally don't. Do I massively have a big problem with the British government? Yes. From July 2014. You should have listened to her. You should have pushed to get us home. You had over 50 odd high ranking meetings. My sister made this known. How many meetings does it take for you to put your words into action? They always turn around and said, we can't meddle in another country's affairs just as much we would let them. I said, well, that's crap. Because any other country comes, has their personnel locked in a British prison and they cry, oh, we're like, oh, okay, okay, we'll release them. So why can't you do that? If you can show the Indian government of our innocence, then why aren't they going to let us go? So while we're languishing, whether it be in a hostel at the time or when we get convicted again and go into prison, you know, I just wanted my government to do more. I believed they could have done more. They said they couldn't. And the reason being is because there was India-UK trade deals. They're not going to knack them up for six British other. So, like I say, it was a nightmare. It was a horrible, difficult situation to be in. And it was only going to get worse. However, we didn't know that. Like just going back to July 2014, blokes were doing cartwheels because we're free. And then day 88, boom, appeal went into the Supreme Court. Damped our hopes in an instant. Destroyed a lot of men, I believe that did. It did. I think it did, especially as the families. It did with me. It did with my family. You know, my mum's getting excited. 2 more days. I'm a free man. Nah. I'm not even too sure if the family heard about it before I did. But it wasn't good telling them, oh, by the way, I'm not going home. I'm not coming home just yet. So, well, how long is it going to take? How long is a piece of string? We're now going through the Supreme Court in India. And we know how many ongoing court cases are going on there. It ain't going to happen very quick. And it didn't. But it's something that you deal with till you have to, you know, do anything court related. We didn't go to Supreme Court. Obviously, you don't. I think one or two travelled up. I wasn't going to travel up. I had a partner at the time. I met a lovely woman in Chennai. So I was seeing her. So I'm not going to travel up to New Delhi and not understand what's going on. Pointless. But like after hearing what happened in Supreme Court, which kind of sealed our fate, I think back now and I'm like, someone has to take responsibility for that. And they know they did wrong. They didn't want to admit it at first, but they know they did wrong. And it wasn't our country this time, funny enough. It was someone else's. Estonian. However, they didn't properly brief up their, you know, lawyers. And in India, there's a caste system. It's mad. Like, even though he's a better lawyer than that lawyer, because he comes from a different caste which is better than his, he can go first. And I'm thinking, eh? So you got the day of the races up at the Supreme Court, you've got the prosecution waffling their utter fantasy story. You've got our lawyer stating we were there for fuel and provisions, nothing more. Then the Estonians, because as time went on, we became a split faction. Tempers run high. People get frustrated. People don't trust certain lawyers, so they end up getting their own. Obviously, the Estonians got their own lawyer. I know. I provided them with a freaking paperwork, and this is how they repay me. You know what I mean? All they had to tell their lawyer was, you're getting fuel and provisions, end of. 2 votes to 1, free. Home. Bye. What does he turn around and say? Well, I don't know why the vessel was there, because the judge asked the question. Right, can you tell me why the vessel was there? Right? Their lawyer turned around and went, I don't know why the vessel was there. I'm just here to get these Estonians home. They're just crew. They've done nothing wrong. Well, the judge stopped listening after you saying, I don't know why the vessel was here. He stopped listening after that because he had enough. He had enough. I don't know. So they're saying one thing, we're saying one thing, and they're saying another. 3 different answers to one question. Well, you've gave the judge no help at all, apart from, right, we need to get to the bottom of this. A trial must happen. And we're like, oh, no. Well, Q Branch were loving it because guess where the trial's going to be? Back in their court in Tuticorin, back at the beginning in the lion's den, hornet's nest, whatever you want to refer it to. They were more or less licking their lips and doing cartwheels under that Delhi court. And we're thinking, oh my God, you've just messed it up, you absolute arseholes. Pardon me, French. That's how, and it wasn't nice. They were kind of regarded as dicks for a short, but yeah, everyone kisses and makes up eventually. We're all in this together, whether we like it or not. Some people have just come to meet each other for the first time. Some people knew each other. We all have different backgrounds, different ways of dealing with things, but we're all together. We all have to try and, you know, work as a team as best as we can. It was difficult. There were split factions once we got convicted, but people were getting tired. People were getting angry. People were getting upset, scared, whether we were ever going to see the light of day again, to be with our families. And I understand that. I really did, because I felt that. You know, getting told, right, you're going to court, but it's not going to start till, well, the next thing was July. Then they went, right, we're going to start the court in September. So traveling to the court dates, and I was just like, this is bullshit, man. I told my lawyer, I said, unless the judge requires me to be here, I ain't coming. I'll speak to the guys. They'll brief me up. They'll find out. Because some of the brick guys, they put a case paperwork up to give to the lawyers, but made out that the lawyers did it themselves, because that's how they acted. And we had everything going into that trial, everything. They didn't stand a chance. They had no leg to stand on. It's quite ironic when they had the map and the judge's like, well, where was the ship? And they're looking at the map going, And I'm thinking, you don't even know where we were. So who told you? Who told you where we were? You can't even remember. Oh, yeah, the agent. That's who told you. That slimy piece of shit. He sold her. And I'm quite adamant that's the truth. He sold her down the river. It all comes apparent when you find out the paperwork during the trial, how much money was sent to the agent to get this fuel and provisions, and how much was left. It was all third-partied, get the cheapest, and the money left over, well, the company just writes that off, because they can make that back in a day, if not less. That was his green card. That was his green ticket, buying his way out, buying his freedom while we suffer. Because why wasn't the agent getting prosecuted? You know, so many questions, so many rumours you hear, so many this, so many that, and you're getting all this in your head and you're thinking, I don't know what to believe. So it was quite difficult. But the court for the trial was horrible. I turned up a few times, and I said to my lawyer, I said, till the judge requires me to be here, I'm not coming no more. And the reason being is because I obviously had the translator from our lawyer telling me what when they were doing the cross references with the so-called personnel that they were interviewing. Give a statement. You weren't there, but write a statement. Mental. Just stop someone in the street. Yeah, will you sign this statement saying these done illegal act? That's what it was like. It was mental. And it was the collector of evidence. But it didn't matter what he said. They still take his original statement. So even when he's getting grilled by our lawyers, when he's getting cross-referenced, he turns around and says, well, if I saw the ballistics report, I wouldn't have put the charges on the men. So you put weapons offences on 35 men for six weapons or five weapons that you deemed were illegal, which weren't illegal. But the ballistic experts report would have told you that they're not illegal. But you couldn't be bothered because you were pressurized by Q Branch, or probably a nice little peer backhander, to put the charges on us so we could go to prison. Mental. Absolute mental. I was just sick to my stomach. I was like, I'm not coming down here. I'm not. Unless it's me getting released. So that went a few months.
Sorry to interrupt. But what is Q Branch?
Q Branch was the name of the police organization that was in charge of the investigation. A lady headed it up. I actually met her personally. And she couldn't care. I showed her pictures of me mum with tubes coming out of her head after operation. I said, you caused this. I had the letters from the lawyers stating you're illegally holding her against her will, abusing your own Indian law. She wasn't interested. She went, well, we'll let the courts decide. And I went, well, make sure your prosecutor turns up, because prosecutors in the UK, if they don't turn up, I think the court gets the case gets thrown out, or they'll be like, right, we'll reconvene once we get someone to act as a temporary prosecutor. They just went, 2 weeks. We'll delay it 2 weeks because the prosecutor didn't turn up. But like during the court with a trial, it was horrible. It was sickening, disgusting. I didn't want to be there. And I would get briefed up by the Brit guys who were there. And then I would brief my family up. But I wouldn't put any of my take on it. I would copy and paste. And then me and my family would discuss. I'm not going to say, well, get it off my lawyer via one of the Brit guys, emailed to me, and then just... yeah, I'll give you my take. I wasn't there, ma'am or dad, but I just went copy paste, send, discuss, what do we do now, how are you feeling, blah blah blah. And then it came towards Christmas. We all were there. The lawyers said before we went for Christmas recess, we've done everything we can. I think it would be a madman to deny use your freedom. An absolute madman. So Christmas comes, Christmas goes, January comes. The big day comes, Judgment Day, January 10th or 11th, one of the two, can't remember. Should remember, but... there's certain things you tend to forget because you don't want to know. You just remember the incident. And that's what I do anyways. And the media was going crazy. I was the last to turn up in court. You see actually video footage of me coming to court like that because I'm late, because the media was doing my tits in. I was like, I need to go, trying to find a tuk-tuk driver out. And everyone was in the court. We were at the back, stood by the bench. Down the right side, we had the legal team representing us, consular staff from the Estonian Embassy, British government. On the left were Bill Benn, the flower pot men, and their crew. And then the judge and his assistants at the front. And... you know, a bit of this, a bit of that, all in Tamil. And then one of the judge's assistants, he stands up and he says something in Tamil. And, one of our embassy staff didn't know how quick to get out that door. She was straight on the blower, straight on that phone. Madame Q Branch, as we referred her to, she did the same. She nearly tripped on her sorry running out that courtroom. She didn't know how fast to vacate it. I was like, you bastard. Sorry for me French there, but I was thinking, you can't even, you horrible, nasty, devious woman. You've just destroyed my life and all the other people around me. Yeah. So anyways, this judge assistant says something. And we're like, what's he said? What's he said? And our legal representative came over, and I've seen some scared faces in my time. They've been in Iraq and Afghanistan. You see, you know, kids' faces and they're scared. And women and children scared. But I've never seen a man so petrified in his life. He's having to tell 35 men, quite big, burly men, they are being sentenced to 5 years. And he told us, and he went, you've been sentenced to 5 years. And we're like, what? What? You're joking, aren't you? It was just, I would say, like, bemused, shocked, confused. Everything was just going on. And I was like, what the hell do I do? I've got stuff in me in the hotel room down in Tutankhamun. I've got me stuff up in Chennai. What the hell is going to happen? Because they're not going to just let me go back and sort my stuff out to then come back and go to prison, are they? Because they'll be thinking, well, you'll do a runner. Which I would. I would have done a runner. I wouldn't have gone. I already tried to pull that trick, but then I realised it's going to cause more problems than good. But, you know, when your mind thinks of weird and wonderful things and you're at the bottom of your morale, you just try and think of stuff to escape. I wouldn't have been able to escape prison, but escape India. But, however, it is quite hard. I stand out like a sore thumb. So that was knocked on the head. So, yeah, we're all, you know, dismissed from the court just to stand around while things, paperwork were getting sorted. There was loads of police officers, prison guards around. That's when I knew something wasn't right, when I saw them all turn up alongside the court doors. I was like, you know, I said to one of the Estonians, this doesn't look like this. And there wasn't. My gut instinct was right. The nightmare's continuing, but it's now getting worse. I'm getting sentenced to 5 years. I've already done all this. So we're now in 2016. I've been there since 2013. Now I've got to make sure my family know this wonderful news. One of the hardest things I've ever had to. I ring my sister. I said, Lisa, you need to get the mams now. She went, okay, I'm going there now. And my mam's friend was assisting my mam, getting her ready and stuff like that, because my mam requires carers now. And I said, I'll ring you back once I've rung Dad. So I rang my dad and I said, Dad, it's not good. He goes, what do you mean it's not good? I said, we've been sentenced to 5 years. My dad's not one for showing emotions. I've only really seen his emotions when I told him I was going to Afghanistan. He's not a one for showing his emotions. I said, Dad, we're getting put in prison for 5 years, weapons. He says, but the weapons are fine. I said, yes, Dad, I know. This is corruption at its highest order. He says, so what happens now? I said, well, this is the last phone call for however long. You know what I mean? Like, what do you say? And then obviously I ring back my sister. She puts us on loudspeaker. And I say it to my sister, are we ready? She says, yeah. I said, that's not good, you know. She says, what? I said, it's not good. I've been sentenced to 5 years. And in that moment, when humans or an animal is badly injured, they make off one hell of a scream, a horrible sound. And that's how my mum sounded. I've never heard a human make such noise in my entire life. How do you digest knowing your mum screaming down the phone because her little baby's boy's going to prison for 5 years on top of the time he's doing and he's not coming home? What do you do? How do you take that on board? I was just like, I'm going to strangle that bastard. I want to strangle him right now for the pain he's just caused my family. But that's going to make matters worse.
Which specific guy do you want to strangle?
The judge. I wanted to strangle the judge on the decision he's just made. I'm just like, what on earth has possessed you to do that? How much have they bought you for? And we were told by Indians, you're in the worst state of India. They don't like the British. The lower courts are run by the police. The best way is to get away from them courts. I'm like, yeah, it would have been great to have a trial at the High Court, but unfortunately, that doesn't happen. It's just an appeals. The trials start at the lower court. Or a big, big incident, Supreme Court. Or we're speaking with the embassy and they arranged to get our stuff from the hotel. And I rung my partner at the time. I said, look, it's not good. She started crying down the phone. I thought, oh, how am I? She composed herself just, bless her. I said, look, I need you to do me a favour. Can you go to the hostel? Can you pack me belongings? Can you take them to the embassy? I'm going to prison for 5 years. Do me this favour. Forget about me. Get on with your life. I didn't want to do that, but I had to. But I didn't get rid of her, because she showed love and loyalty. She went to that prison the next day to try and see me. And she did that for every day of that week. The embassy were trying to get her in, but because she was from Assam and I'm a white British guy, they weren't going to allow her in. She did eventually get in, but it took a couple of months later when my sister came to visit me in March for my birthday. So yeah, that's us convicted. Back on the bus, back on with police guards, prison guards with weapons. You don't know the state of their weapons. They're falling asleep. Weapons are going all over. I'm like, get that out of my face, man. You know, bloody killers. They're driving like lunatics. We're screaming for nearly 14 hours. Guess what? We had a tyre blowout. I was like, oh, we're not even going to make it to prison. We're going to die on the side of the road here. Fortunately, we didn't roll, but it could have been worse. So then we had to wait for another bus to come and get with to then finish the journey. But we're not handcuffed, so the prison guards were proper on edge, because if we wanted to do something, we would have done something. Just thrown Indian prison guards about. We would have. We could have disarmed them all, strangled them, and done away. But what would that achieve? 23 white foreigners cutting around India. That's not going to be a difficult task to get arrested again, is it? Stand out like a sore thumb. So you just go with it, hope for the best that you make it there in one piece. So we arrived back to the same prison, but next door, Central Prison 1, the prison they go to once you've been convicted. And it was daylight, and the jailer at the time, we left when she was superintendent. She was the jailer. She rocked up, welcomed her as best as she could. And that was it. 5 years, start now.
Now, if you want to find out what happens next, please listen to part 2 of Nick Dunn's story, available next Wednesday, where he talks about starting his 5-year prison sentence, using his military training to survive, and then, almost 2 years later, Nick and the rest of the Chennai Six get acquitted by an appeals court, and Nick gets ready to fly home to the UK. Thank you for listening to Port Hostage Diplomacy. Take care.